underneath the radar or higher than the range of air defense missiles, to deliver high-yield payloads more precisely than missiles could do. Thus it gave support to the Air Force proposals for the B-70 bomber program, later called the B-1. General Curtis LeMay, the former head of SAC, was by instinct hostile to ideas that downplayed attacks on cities, but he wanted the Air Force to have big, high-flying, fast bombers that could carry a heavy payload, and he was passionately devoted to the B-70 program. My friend, Lieutenant Colonel Bob Lukeman, said to me that he had heard a civilian in the Pentagon, on being told by a general officer that the first priority of the Air Force in 1961 was to get the B-70, ask what its second priority was. He was told, "There is no second priority." Lukeman explained to me, "The Air Force has one priority at a time." The counterforce strategy also implied a crash effort to improve the accuracy of our missiles. That was another objective then thought to disfavor the Navy's mobile missile, the Polaris, in favor of land-based missiles controlled by the Air Force. Meanwhile, it called for large numbers of the land-based missiles to compensate for their current inaccuracy against small and hardened military targets. Before the year was out, LeMay and General Thomas Power, who had earlier replaced LeMay as the head of SAC, were calling for 10,000 of the prospective Minuteman land-based ICBMs. In making this pitch to McNamara, Kaufman certainly gave him what our RAND USAF sponsors wanted in the way of a rationale for the B-70, and for land-based missiles controlled by the Air Force. Whether he truly believed in the pitch for the Air Force's counterforce mission, I never knew for sure. Others at RAND were unconvinced by the Kaufman USAF strategy. Yet it was not unwelcome to RAND management and analysts to find that Kaufman's briefing was met with enthusiasm by both Air Force High Command, some of whose subordinates had actually inspired it, and by the new Secretary of Defense. I was one of the doubters, and so was Harry Rowan. On the basis of the calculations I'd seen at RAND, the merits of counterforce attacks and limiting damage either to the target area or to the United States did not impress me. Assuming as we did in the spring of 1961 that the Soviets had sizable numbers of ICBMs, before long to be hardened and accompanied by sub-launched missiles, it seemed obvious to me that once a process of general nuclear war was underway, nothing could be relied on very much to limit damage to less than catastrophic levels. Thus, there was an incalculably vast premium for all nuclear powers on deterring, preventing, and avoiding a general nuclear war under any circumstances. However, the question remained, what did we do if deterrence failed? Like Kaufman, I accepted the notion that if a general nuclear war did commence, our land-based missiles should be aimed at military targets, primarily Soviet missiles and air bases, for whatever prospect of limiting damage that might offer. But what seemed to me to offer relatively more promise than simply the damage limiting by controlled counterforce attacks that Kaufman was expounding were the other parts of the coercive no-cities strategy he had presented to McNamara, aimed at terminating the war as quickly as possible before all weapons on both sides had been employed, and particularly before any, many, or all had been employed against urban targets. It was a long time before I recognized the fatal contradictions between these two components of what was supposed to be the same strategy, along with the effective infeasibility of either of them. This latter goal required both deterring, if possible, an opponent from launching strikes against the cities of the United States and its allies, even if nuclear war was initiated by one side or the other, and at the same time inducing the opponent's command authority to stop operations short of expending all his weapons. Both of these sub-goals called for three characteristics in our own planning and operations. First, it meant avoiding enemy cities altogether in our own initial strikes, what came to be known as a no-cities approach. We would have to announce that intention long before hostilities began. Right away, this would be a marked departure from a policy of indicating beforehand and then carrying out our intent to destroy cities in all circumstances, a policy that removed any restraint on the enemy from targeting our own cities. Second, it required maintaining protected and controlled U.S. reserve forces under virtually all circumstances, thus preserving a threat capability in order to terminate the war. That might also deter enemy preparations to destroy our cities as an inevitable and automatic wartime strategy. Third, it called for preserving on both sides a command and control system capable of both controlling reserve forces and terminating operations. We would need a survivable command system capable of more than a simple go decision, and we could not afford to deprive the Soviets of the same capability. The first two of these points were part of Kaufman's briefing to McNamara in early 1961. They were rooted in RAND discussions and studies going back years before I arrived there, starting with Bernard Brody, Andrew Marshall, Jim Digby, Charlie Hitch, and others, as Fred Kaplan has ably shown. Both notions appealed to me from my own background as soon as I encountered them at RAND. No cities, from my earliest aversion to bombing civilians. The notion of inducing the Soviets possibly to do the same, and to end the war by holding their own cities hostage to our reserve forces, was in line with my more recent analysis of coercion. That focus led me to emphasize, more than others did, the key importance of preserving command and control on both sides, not only our own. That turned out to be an insuperable disability of the approach in the eyes of military planners on both sides. Neither I nor Harry Rowan had at that time the illusion that any such planned measures had a great likelihood of achieving the desired effects, either on enemy planning or on the course of hostilities. Still, the possibility of having some desirable effect, saving some, perhaps many cities on both sides, and ending a war, once started, short of mutual annihilation, seemed greater than with the air staff strategy, which focused exclusively on counterforce tactics, and failed to provide any mechanism for either terminating the war or significantly limiting damage. This combination of damage-limiting and war-terminating goals implied that there were some choices to be made by the highest surviving U.S. authority, even after general war hostilities had begun. Given the nature and urgency of such decisions, which might mean life or death for our entire society, it was obviously desirable that the president himself, or at least someone having his full confidence, be physically capable of making such decisions after general war had begun. Eisenhower's wholly pre-planned, truly single integrated operational plan didn't really require this. That required preserving the president or his representative physically, as well as preserving reliable communication capabilities. At the same time, I saw a second, more important advantage in demanding that a highest civilian authority be able to choose among options, even in the midst of war. It provided a rationale, a need to know, for the president to inform himself and his civilian advisers before the war of the detailed nature of the proposed war planning. And there was a third advantage to my plan. Once it was acknowledged that the capability of highest-level authority, civilian or military, to command should be preserved during war, and once physical measures had been taken to achieve that with high reliability, there could no longer be compelling military objections against implementing lower-level physical controls over nuclear weapons, permissive action links, PALs, that would make it impossible for lower commanders to mistakenly or insubordinately initiate the use of nuclear weapons on their own. Finally, focusing critical attention on the existing, current plans, which called for the prompt destruction of Soviet and Chinese urban targets under all circumstances of general war, opened up the possibility of a strategic and moral critique of such plans. Up until now, these plans had been regarded as beyond question, especially by civilians, because there was supposedly no alternative to them for purposes of deterrence or wartime operations. My personal hope was that higher-level civilian scrutiny of these plans could eliminate, or at least greatly reduce, the probability of the particular insanities that involve targeting China in all circumstances of war with the Soviet Union, and of automatically targeting cities en masse either in China or in the USSR. By emphasizing the importance of withholding reserve forces, which meant mainly city-busting Polaris missiles, and withholding initial attacks on cities, I privately hoped to avert or minimize attacks on cities altogether, whether we struck preemptively or in retaliation. Such an approach called for drastic changes in both plans and preparations from the posture that had developed since 1953, culminating in 1960. For that reason, it seemed clear that the new BNSP should be drafted in considerable concrete detail, rather than being the brief and vague document which the military had come to expect in the years when it simply reaffirmed the existing New Look doctrine, which emphasized reliance on nuclear weapons, both strategic and tactical, largely for long-haul budgetary reasons. Moreover, although in principle the BNSP directive officially defined national policy, rather than arguing for it, some of these notions were so unfamiliar in classified strategic dialogue that it seemed desirable to smuggle in as much rationale as possible, both to undermine resistance and to introduce the planners to considerations that had not recently appeared in military writing. For example, even a high civilian planner in the Defense Department, having been kept unfamiliar with the details of these plans and preparations by military bureaucratic secrecy, could have been expected to wonder why it was necessary to specify in the highest level policy document something as obvious as the need for maintaining reserve forces. The answer, remarkably, was that the highest level war plans for the United States at that time called for the immediate expenditure of all weapons as soon as they could be made operationally ready, under all circumstances of initiation of general war, armed conflict with the Soviet Union. In other words, these plans and all supporting training and preparation not only failed to provide for the maintaining and subsequent commitment of any tactical or strategic reserves, the core consideration in classical military planning, but they positively required that there should be no meaningful reserves. Moreover, to avoid the previous ambiguity of the meaning of general war, Kaufman and I agreed in our drafts to use the term central war, a RAND term, as distinguished from local war, instead of limited war. Central war was defined in my draft, later signed by McNamara, as war involving deliberate nuclear attacks instituted by government authority upon the homelands of one or both of the two major powers, the United States and the Soviet Union. That was in the spirit of the narrow definition of general war proposed by the Army and Navy in earlier disputes, rejected by the Air Force, Secretary of Defense Gates, and President Eisenhower. There was no longer in our guidance a concept of general war, defined simply as armed conflict with the Soviet Union. Local war was defined in our drafts as any other armed conflict. The previous JSCAP concept of limited war, as distinct from war with the Soviet Union, was discarded because we proposed to aim at limiting, if possible, even hostilities with the Soviet Union, even in Central War. In the late afternoon of April 7, 1961, with a good deal of satisfaction, I wrote the last line of my first draft of the General War section of the BNSP. I remember looking up at the clock on the wall in the outer ISA office where I was typing, and noticing that it was 5 p.m. For the first time that day, it occurred to me that it was my birthday. I was 30. I remember thinking, for the rest of my life, I won't have done anything more important than this. I told Harry that it was my birthday, and I had finished a first draft. He said that we should knock off early and celebrate. He took me out to dinner. Some days later, I had a finished product. This took the form of a 12-page discussion of goals, contingencies, and requirements, intended to make both the desired changes and the reasoning for them fully explicit to the military planners working on the JSCAP and the subordinate plans. To an uninformed reader, nearly everyone outside the actual nuclear planning process, including the Secretary of Defense and the President, these proposed policies would probably appear commonsensical. And so they were, except for the fact that almost every sentence constituted a radical challenge to and departure from some fundamental characteristic of the then-existing plans and preparations. For instance, my proposal to retain a strategic reserve, particularly of the city-busting Polaris missiles, ran completely counter to the previous plan, in which all ready vehicles, including the Polaris missiles, were committed to pre-planned targets as soon as possible. My insistence on the importance of maintaining reliable command and control ran against the notion that unauthorized initiative might be necessary, either at high military levels of command or at low, an attitude that increased the possibility of unauthorized initiative in a time of crisis, under the stress of ambiguous indications or an outage of communications with higher command. While there existed physical safeguards against accidents, there had been almost none against unauthorized action, either in connection with individual vehicles or in command post operations. I proposed that such safeguards could take the form of a combination lock on weapons, requiring a code sent by higher authority to unsafe or release the weapon, some form of PALS. The rigid PSYOP provided for no distinction between the USSR and China. It allowed for no avoidance or postponement of attacks on cities. It allowed for no option to minimize non-military casualties. It offered no option for preserving enemy command and control capability. In contrast, I called for flexible contingency planning that allowed for all these options. Existing planning allowed for no stop order once an authenticated execute order was received by SAC forces. Since this unleashed attacks on all major Sino-Soviet urban industrial centers and governmental and military control centers, this policy maintained no plausible basis for inducing any Soviet commanders or units to terminate operations prior to expending all their weapons upon U.S. and Allied cities. I proposed that a secure system of command and control was necessary to allow the option of limiting or terminating a conflict before all our forces were deployed, with reliable stop or recall orders. All this was laid out in a memo for Harry Rowan, Paul Nitze, and Secretary of Defense McNamara, listing some of the limitations of the current plans I had intended to redress. A second memo listed some of the changes my draft guidance called for. Elimination of the PSYOP as a single automatic response in Central War. Elimination of the automatic inclusion of China and Soviet satellite states. Plans to withhold some survivable forces, and an initial avoidance of enemy cities and governmental and military controls. The requirement of a survivable, flexible command and control system, headed by the president or as high an authoritative figure as possible. An effort to induce the enemy to terminate war by not destroying all major urban industrial areas at the outset. Plans and preparations to use conventional weapons in local conflict, up to large-scale conflict, in addition to plans to use nuclear weapons. Rejection of any single inflexible plan to be adopted for use in a wide range of circumstances of Central War, let alone the PSYOP. Or that any given set of targets should be marked for immediate automatic destruction under all conditions of Central War. And rejection of the inevitability of Central War in war with the Soviet Union. On the basis of these memos, as well as an additional one that laid out steps that could be implemented in the short run, I got word from McNamara's office that I should prepare a draft for the Secretary to send to the JCS, directing SINCSAC, as Director of Strategic Target Planning, to explore and make concrete recommendations for introducing command flexibility and alternative options to the war plans in the relatively short run. I had spent an afternoon with Alan Anthoven in his Office of Systems Analysis, roughing out options in line with my guidance, which were refined in specifics by his RAND consultants, Frank Trinkle and Dave McGarvey, on whom both Alan and Bill Kaufman had long relied for crucial calculations. When I showed my first draft to Colonel Lukeman on the joint staff, he warned me that it wasn't tactful enough to get a helpful response from General Power. In particular, Power would be offended by the implication that there weren't any real alternative options in the current plan. They had, after all, what they called options in the plan, although they all involved attack by already forces, and eventually all forces, with none in reserve, against the same target list. He edited my draft to make it less provocative to SAC, posing questions, then adding a sentence beginning, "Recognizing that these plans already permit a variety of options keyed to duration of warning, geographic discretion, constraints, and specifics of weather and visibility." The final version, redrafted for Deputy Secretary of Defense Roswell Gilpatrick's signature, was sent to the JCS chairman on May 5, 1961, with the heading, policy guidance on plans for Central War, along with my draft portion of the proposed BNSP. For texts of all these memos and drafts, see Ellsberg.net/BNSP. My revised guidance became the basis for the operational war plans under Kennedy, reviewed by me for Deputy Secretary Gilpatrick in 1962, 1963, and again in the Johnson administration in 1964. It has been reported by insiders and scholars to have been a critical influence on U.S. strategic war planning ever since. Years later, when I mentioned to a friend that I had finished my first draft of the top-secret guidance to planning for general nuclear war on my 30th birthday, his uncharitable reaction was, "That's frightening." I said, "True, but you should have seen the plan I was replacing." In years to come, the memory of this accomplishment did not bring me the same satisfaction it brought when I was 30. Chapter 9. Questions for the Joint Chiefs. How many will die? In the spring of 1961, Harry Rowan told me that after my briefing to McGeorge Bundy in January, Bundy had called the director of the Joint Staff of the JCS and asked him to send over a copy of the JSCAP. The director told him, "Oh, we can't release that." Bundy said, "The president wants to read it." The director said, "But we've never released that. I can't." Bundy told him, "You don't seem to be hearing me. It's the president who wants it. We'll brief him on it." Bundy said, "The president is a great reader. He wants to read it." It was finally agreed, Harry told me, that the president would get the JSCAP and a briefing by a member of the Joint Staff. Soon after I had finished drafting the basic national security policy, Rowan and I were talking to Deputy Secretary of Defense Roswell Gilpatrick in his office in the Pentagon, and Gilpatrick remarked to me, "By the way, we finally got the JSCAP." He said that instead of sending it over to the White House, the Joint Staff had finally negotiated that they would give a briefing on it in Gilpatrick's office. McNamara had attended, and McGeorge Bundy came over from the White House. I asked him if they had seen an actual copy of the plan after all. He said yes. The briefer had left the plan with him. I asked if I could see it. Gilpatrick led us into his safe. Instead of a safe with drawers, he had a long closet that had been converted into a bank-like vault with a heavy steel door. It had a tall ceiling and reinforced walls lined with library shelves, filled with documents stamped "Top Secret" and higher. He found a document lying on one of the shelves near the front and handed it to me. At a glance, it didn't look to me like the JSCAP, because it was typed on regular 8x10-inch paper, not the heavier 11x14-inch legal-size pages of a finished JCS document. Well, I thought, they might have just retyped it on regular-size paper for the deputy secretary. I looked immediately for the key section that appeared nowhere else but in the JSCAP, the part that the JCS had taken such care to withhold from civilians, the definition of general war. It wasn't there. There was no definition section, no definition of general war or limited war. I looked back to the first page and read the heading. It didn't say Joint Strategic Capabilities Plan. It said Briefing on the JSCAP. Even that went beyond the terms of the earlier JCS directive I had seen, which told the Joint Staff that neither the title Joint Strategic Capabilities Plan nor the initials JSCP are to be used in correspondence with the Office of Secretary of Defense. This heading broke that rule by using the forbidden initials JSCP, apparently because Bundy's call to the director had revealed that that cat was out of the bag. Someone had leaked the acronym, at least. But it wasn't yet clear to the Joint Staff that the White House or the Office of the Secretary of Defense knew more than the acronym, new contents of the plan and their implications, and the JCS hadn't yet given that up. I told Gilpatrick, "This isn't the JSCAP. Is this all they gave you?" He looked taken aback, for once confused. He said, "Yes, it is. But I'm certain they told me it was the JSCAP. They were leaving me a copy of the JSCAP. Are you sure it isn't?" I showed him the title. It's not the JSCAP. It's a copy of the briefing they gave you. I remarked on the size of the paper and told him about the crucial part that was missing. Evidently, they had left that out of the briefing. There might be more they had omitted. Gilpatrick seemed more embarrassed than angry. He said, "They told me they'd be glad to answer any questions we might have from the briefing and the paper. Would you take this and write out some questions for me to send to them?" I took the briefing paper back to the room where I was working in Rowan's suite of offices and put it in the safe. Then I walked down to an office in the Air Staff and asked Lieutenant Colonel Bob Lukeman, who had originally shown me the JSCAP, if I could borrow a copy again. I didn't tell him what it was for, and he gave it to me without any questions. Within minutes I was back in my office with the paper that Bundy, speaking for the President, and the Secretary of Defense had been unable to get. There were, as before, some advantages to being from RAND. The Air Staff thought of us as one of them. That was why I'd been shown the JSCAP the year before. But by this time, in 1961, Lukeman knew that I was a consultant to the Secretary of Defense, which would normally have meant, and did mean for the Air Force Chief of Staff, that I was working for the enemy, as formidable an adversary as the Navy or Congress. He had to have gotten in advance the approval of his immediate boss, Brigadier General Glenn Kent, for him to be showing me anything. I gathered that what was true for my friend the Colonel must also be true for his boss. They disagreed with the policy embraced by the highest levels of the Air Force, wanted to see it changed, and were using me as a channel to the civilian authorities to make an end run around their own superiors. I put the JSCAP on the table next to the copy of the briefing paper from Gilpatrick and began to compare them line by line. I made a list of the discrepancies and then began to lay out issues to be put to the JCS. I have my rough notes on questions for them. It took me a week of long days to finish them. Some of these probed for the rationale of attacking cities and populations en masse, immediately or ever, under all, or for that matter, any circumstances of war initiation. That was an aspect of the optimum mix concept that was embodied in the PSYOP. I asked, why are major urban industrial centers or government controls to be attacked concurrently with nuclear delivery capabilities? What national objectives require that urban industrial centers be on the minimum essential list for initial attack? By what reasoning are these essential? What would be the costs in terms of U.S. objectives to omitting attack on these targets, relying upon residual strength to achieve objectives listed above? What is the distribution by type of targets in the satellite states? What contribution do they make to immediate Sino-Soviet bloc offensive capabilities? What is the total megatonnage dropped in the alert case, in the strategic warning case, full force? What is the total of fission products? How much is airburst, how much groundburst? What would worldwide fallout be? What worldwide casualties? To what extent and in what precise ways does the planned attack upon urban industrial centers and bonus targets differ from an attack intended to maximize population loss in the Soviet Union? In communist China? In what ways will the execution of such attacks under several conditions of war initiation contribute to U.S. wartime or post-war objectives? Does the plan proceed on the assumption that it is national policy to hold the population of the USSR and communist China responsible for acts of their governments? Are communist Chinese people held responsible for acts of the Soviet government? Other questions pointed to the lack of flexibility in the planning, another aspect of the PSYOP, Annex C of the JSCAP, guidance for the operational plans of SAC and Polaris, not mentioned as such in the briefing. The plan provides for optimum employment, under the several conditions under which hostilities may be initiated. What are examples of those several conditions, other than Soviet surprise nuclear attack? How does the planned response differ for all the different conditions? Is a single, uniform response optimal for all? Why do all options provide for total expenditure of the force? Why is no provision made for a strategic reserve? What is the ability of the JCS to accept the surrender of the enemy forces during the execution of the PSYOP? What preparations have been made for this event? Have acceptable surrender terms been drafted? How reliable is the capability to stop remaining attacks after execute orders have been transmitted? Have preparations been made to monitor conformity to surrender terms? Some of my questions couldn't possibly have occurred to anyone simply from reading the briefing. I threw them in to warn the recipients that someone working for Gilpatric was already familiar with the problems of the operational planning. Does planned coordination assume that all offensive vehicles will get the execute message simultaneously? If so, what is the estimated validity of this assumption? What will effects on coordination be of estimated lags in receipt of message? Or of different wind direction and strength affecting different parts of the attacking forces in planning to avert interference? Since these questions were supposedly coming from Gilpatric, who hadn't been given the JSCAP, I had to find a way to draft them so that they would purport to be based only on the briefing paper that the JCS had given to him. But anyone who knew the actual plans would know that the person writing those questions was not Gilpatric. It had to be someone who was intimately familiar with the JSCAP itself and all the controversies that lay behind it, who probably had a copy of it sitting in front of him. In other words, the joint staff and their bosses, the JCS, would know immediately that a copy of the JSCAP had finally found its way to the office of the Secretary of Defense. Moreover, they would know that someone who was either a military planner himself, a mole, or who had been very well educated by such planners was advising the Deputy Secretary. The questions were the message. They were intended to leak into the JCS the news that their processes, their conflicts, compromises, and maneuvers had become transparent to the Office of the Secretary of Defense. I hoped they would figure the game was up. They had to come clean and give straight answers. They had to fear that any efforts to lie or evade would be quickly spotted by whoever wrote these questions. He might actually know, through some direct channel, their inner discussions of how to deal with the problem of responding to Gilpatric. Each question, still more the whole set, was designed to convey that someone working for Gilpatric knew, as military staffers used to say, where all the bodies were buried. It would be clear not only that he knows the JSCAP and he's got a copy, but also that he knew somehow why it was written the way it was, where the controversies were, how they had been papered over, and all the other things that would be hard or impossible for the JCS to explain or justify. I don't have the final memo that I submitted to Gilpatric, in which the questions were more elegantly phrased than above. To keep up the pretense, however transparent to the recipients, that the questions were based on the briefing to Gilpatric, rather than on the JSCAP itself, most of my 30 or so queries started with a reference to a statement in the briefing paper, and then presented a list of sub-questions purporting to relate to it. I happen to recall verbatim the wording of the first question. You say on page 1 that each operational plan is submitted for review and approval to the next higher level of command. A. Was the JSCAP submitted to Secretary of Defense Gates for his review and approval? B. When in the annual planning cycle, is it customary to submit the JSCAP to the Secretary of Defense for his review and approval? True answers would have been A, no, and B, never. It was obvious that the drafter of the questions knew that. It was not obvious what a satisfactory explanation of those answers would be, or those for the rest of the questions, which tended to get tougher from there. When I handed the list to Gilpatric, he glanced through it, nodded his head, and said appreciatively, "These are very penetrating questions." He read it over more carefully, shook his head several times, thanked me warmly, and sent it off to the joint staff with a cover letter and without any changes. There was no good way for the JCS or its staff to respond to these questions. If they lied or evaded, it was clear they would be found out. But if they answered truthfully, it would have seemed appropriate to send at the same time their letters of resignation. Bob Comer, McGeorge Bundy's deputy at the NSC, put that more strongly. After he read the draft I showed him in his office next door to the White House, he said to me, "If these were Japanese generals, they would have to commit suicide after reading these questions." The generals and admirals who got the questions were not Japanese. They did not commit suicide. But they did get the message. Within hours of the questions being sent, the director of the joint staff was on the phone to Harry Rowan. As Harry told me, he asked very intensely, "Do you know anything about a set of questions we just received from Gilpatrick?" Harry said, "I might." There was a long pause. Then a curt, "Who wrote them?" Harry declined to say. End of conversation. In a season when military staffs were working night and day to meet without fail or delay the secretary's short deadlines on numerous studies, this was the one set of questions that was simply never answered at all. As the first deadline approached, the director asked for an extension, and when time ran out on that, he asked for another, then a third. When I asked Gilpatrick about it in a later meeting, they still had not made a formal reply. They never did. "That's perfect," Gilpatrick told me. "We'll just leave them hanging there. Then if they fight us on the new plans, we'll just say, 'Well then, let's go back to the discussion of your old plans, and we'll start with those questions again.'" Meanwhile, my revised guidelines on basic national security policy were signed by the Secretary of Defense, sent to the JCS as Secretary of Defense Guidance on War Planning, and eventually became the new policy. President Kennedy had decided not to issue a new BNSP in his own name. As it turned out, one of the questions I had drafted for Gilpatrick got a different treatment. As part of the list he sent to the joint staff, it got no more response than the rest, but it was picked out of my list by Bob Comer at the White House and sent to the JCS as a presidential query. And this question, to my surprise, got a quick, specific, and apparently accurate answer. As recounted in the prologue, this question was the following. If existing general war plans were carried out as planned, how many people would be killed in the Soviet Union and China alone? In posing that question originally, my tentative understanding from Lukman and his air staff colleagues was that the JCS had never calculated an up-to-date answer for it for the current operational plans, which called for the quick and reliable destruction of a target system that included every major city in the Soviet Union and China. That might seem a peculiar supposition, but I had a basis for it. Despite my knowledge of the war planning process and the plans themselves, which was extensive and virtually unique for a civilian, I had never seen such an estimate. Colonels Lukman, Craig, and others had told me they had never seen one either, and they believed it did not exist. And it was easy for someone familiar with military bureaucracy to imagine bureaucratic considerations that would have blocked it from ever being investigated, having to do with the fear of leaks to the public, but also with the use that internal military critics of the plans could make of realistically horrific figures. So I thought that the JCS would probably have to admit that they didn't know, or they would have to ask for more time to calculate an answer. Either response would put them off balance in defending their current plans against our proposed alternatives. What? You don't even know the consequences of your own plans for human fatalities? It was to make that as embarrassing as possible that I drafted the question to cover the Soviet Union and China alone, so that they couldn't pretend they needed extra time merely to calculate answers for fatalities in Albania. I thought it was also possible that they would turn out a hasty answer, which could probably be shown to be absurdly low. The only estimates I had ever seen in war plans had that character. They were from the early 1950s and ranged from about 1 million dead in the Soviet Union at the beginning of the decade to up to 10 million or 15 million dead in plans a few years later. I had read those as ridiculously low even for the era of A-bombs, which were already by that time much larger than the Hiroshima and Nagasaki weapons. If they came back with any estimate at all, I expected it would be comparably unrealistic in the era of thermonuclear weapons, H-bombs. New underestimates would serve the same purposes in the inner bureaucratic bargaining over the plans as no estimates at all. The possibility that the JCS would come up quickly with a realistic estimate was one I barely considered. I was mistaken. So were the usually knowledgeable colonels I had consulted. Not only did some section of the joint staff have a plausible computer model for calculating such effects, but they supplied the White House with an answer within a day or two. As I've described earlier, it was classified top secret for the president's eyes only. But since I had drafted the question, Comer called me over to the NSC offices to look at it. The answer was in the form of the graph depicted in the prologue that showed 275 million would die in the first few hours of our attack, and 325 million would be dead within 6 months. I had only asked for fatalities, not for casualties, which would have included wounded and sick. While this was for the Soviet Union and China alone, the speed of their response suggested that they had an existing computer model and probably had estimates on hand for other areas as well. So it proved. I drafted for Comer a follow-up question covering areas contiguous to the Sino-Soviet bloc, and the joint staff provided comprehensive estimates with equal dispatch. These were listed in a table. Another 100 million or so would die in the Eastern European satellite countries from the attacks contemplated in our war plans, many of which were on air defenses and military installations in those countries, most of them near cities, even though Eastern Europe cities were not targeted as such. To open air corridors for subsequent bombers advancing toward the Soviet Union through Warsaw Pact territories, the first wave of bombers would bomb as they go, dropping megaton weapons on radar stations, anti-aircraft installations, and surface-to-air missile sites as they came to them in Eastern Europe. Recall General Power's remark at the PSYOP briefing attended by John Rubel on the unhappy fate of Albania, site of a radar station and route to Russia. Although population destruction was not regarded as a bonus in the captive nations, as it was in the Soviet Union and China, where it was deliberately maximized, most warheads in Eastern Europe, as elsewhere, were groundburst maximizing fallout. Fallout from our surface explosions in the Soviet Union, its satellites, and China would decimate the populations in the Sino-Soviet bloc as well as in all the neutral nations bordering these countries, Finland, Sweden, Austria, and Afghanistan, for example, as well as Japan and Pakistan. Given prevailing wind patterns, the Finns would be virtually exterminated by the fallout from surface bursts on Soviet submarine pens near their borders. These fatalities from U.S. attacks up to another 100 million would occur without a single U.S. warhead landing on the territories of these countries outside the NATO and Warsaw Pacts. Fallout fatalities inside our Western European NATO allies from U.S. attacks against the Warsaw Pact would depend on climate and wind conditions. As a general testifying before Congress put it, these could be up to 100 million European allied deaths from our attacks, depending on which way the wind blows. As I had intended, the JCS had clearly interpreted the phrase, "if your plans were implemented as planned," to mean, if U.S. strategic forces struck first and executed their planned mission without disruption from a Soviet preemptive strike. These figures clearly presumed that all or most U.S. forces had gotten off the ground with their weapons without having been attacked first. That is, it was implicit in these calculations, as in the greater part of our planning, that the United States would be initiating all-out nuclear war, either as escalation of a limited regional conflict that had come to involve Soviet troops, or in preemption of a Soviet nuclear attack of which we had tactical warning. The warning, it was understood, could be a false alarm, or if it were not, the Soviet attack underway might be in response to a Soviet false alarm of a U.S. attack. The phrase "implemented as planned" referred to the assumption on which nearly all our planning was based, that in the whole range of circumstances in which nuclear war was likely to occur, we would take the initiative. Before enemy warheads had arrived or perhaps had been directed to launch, we would be striking first. Thus, the fatalities the JCS were reporting to the White House were the estimated results of a U.S. first strike. The total death count from our own attacks, in the estimates supplied by the Joint Staff, was in the neighborhood of 600 million dead, almost entirely civilians, the greater part inflicted in a day or two, the rest over 6 months. And these were solely the effects of U.S. warheads, not including any effects from Soviet retaliatory attacks on the United States or U.S. and Allied forces in Europe or elsewhere. The CIA intelligence estimate in June 1961 credited the Soviets with well over 100 ICBMs at that time, of which they claimed to be able to locate, and thus to target, only a small fraction. Estimates of U.S. fatalities from Soviet retaliation, consistent with those estimates, would have added scores of millions of U.S. dead to the total, even after a very effective U.S. first strike. Army and Navy estimates of Soviet ICBMs threatening America were a few, but by all estimates, several hundred intermediate and medium-range missiles were aimed at Western Europe, Germany in particular, along with hundreds of medium-range bombers. Even after the most successful U.S. and NATO first strike, Soviet retaliation against Europe could have added 100 million to the Western European death count from blast, fire, and immediate exposure to radiation, even before the fallout from our own attacks had arrived from the east, borne on the wind. Holding the graph in my hand, the answer to my initial query, covering only fatalities from the Soviet Union and China, looking at it in an office of the White House annex on a spring day in 1961, I realized, so they knew. As I said in the prologue, the graph seemed to me the depiction of pure evil. It should not exist. There should be nothing real on earth that it referred to. But what it dealt with was all too real. I had seen some of the smaller bombs myself, H-bombs with an explosive yield of 1.1 megatons each, equivalent to 1.1 million tons of high explosive. Each bomb half the total explosive power of all the bombs of World War II combined. I saw them slung under single-pilot F-100 fighter bombers on alert at Kadena Air Base on Okinawa, ready to take off on 10 minutes' notice. On one occasion I had laid my hand on one of these, not yet loaded on a plane. On a cool day, the smooth metallic surface of the bomb was warm from the radiation within. A body-like warmth. 3,000 warheads like these, most of them much larger in yield, up to 20 times as great, would be delivered on the Soviet bloc and China in the first stage of execution of the PSYOP. Most of them, I knew, would be groundburst, with fallout that would annihilate the population not only of the Sino-Soviet bloc, but of its neighbors, including allies and neutrals. It was not only the size of the numerical estimate of deaths that threw me into a state of shock, though I was not at all used to seeing estimates like that in classified studies. At RAND, I'd read almost exclusively estimates of the population damage the United States could reliably threaten to produce in a retaliatory second strike for purposes of deterring a Soviet first strike. In the context of Albert Wohlstetter's and RAND's concern that a well-designed Soviet Pearl Harbor-like attack might totally eliminate SAC's currently deployed retaliatory forces, the focus in those studies was how to assure that Soviet casualties from U.S. retaliation could be as high as, say, the Soviets had suffered in World War II, in the neighborhood of 20 million. Nothing less, Wohlstetter argued, and his acolytes, like me, accepted, would reliably deter cold-blooded Bolshevik leaders in an intense crisis. I'm not sure I'd ever seen in a RAND study an estimate of the human consequences of a U.S. first strike by an undamaged force, a possibility that was scarcely considered at RAND except by Herman Kahn. But since I'd seen actual war plans in the Pacific and the Pentagon, I'd become aware that they focused preeminently on just such a case, a U.S. first strike, either preemptively or in escalation from a regional conflict. And not, in either case, what RAND analysts would have considered a well-designed first strike that exclusively focused on Soviet military targets, but one that explicitly attacked all Soviet and Chinese cities in the early waves. So I'd long been aware that the destruction wrought by executing such a plan, unimagined by RAND for the United States, would be huge, horrible, beyond the RAND calculations I'd seen. But I'd never formulated a specific measure of it in my own mind, and I'd never seen one. This one seemed realistic. To see it in print was startling, despite the fact that I had long privately thought, while reading war plans during the previous 2 years, that I was looking at the way the civilized world might end. These were plans for destroying the world of cities, plans that someday might be carried out, but I had thought that none of the others reading or writing them had faced up to that. The shock for me was to realize that the Joint Chiefs were, after all, aware of it. Their planning process was not so mindless of overall consequences as I had come to suppose. It was worse. What was beyond surprising, it was unfathomable, was that they felt they could afford to be so candid about this particular answer, so prompt, responsive, realistic, while they stalled on all the others. Far from being accompanied by any offers to resign, there was no evident embarrassment, no shame, apology, or evasion, no apparent awareness of any need for an explanation of this answer to the new president. I thought, this was what the United States had come to, 16 years after Hiroshima. Plans and preparations awaiting only presidential order to execute. And, I discovered, not requiring even that in some circumstances, for whose foreseen consequences the term genocidal was totally inadequate. I myself at that time was not a critic of the explicit logic of deterrence or its legitimacy. On the contrary, I had been urgently working with my colleagues at RAND and in the Pentagon to assure a survivable U.S. capability to threaten clearly unacceptable damage to the Soviet Union in response to the most successful Soviet nuclear attack on the United States. But the planned slaughter of hundreds of millions of Soviets and Chinese, 20 times the staggering deaths of Soviet citizens in World War II, along with an equal number of our allies and citizens of neutral countries, that expected outcome exposed a dizzying irrationality, madness, insanity, at the heart and soul of our nuclear planning and apparatus. The fact is that the estimates of fatalities in terms of what was calculated at the time, even before the discovery of nuclear winter, was a fantastic underestimate. More than 40 years later, Dr. Lynn Eden, a scholar at Stanford Center for International Security and Cooperation, revealed in Whole World on Fire the bizarre fact that the war planners of SAC and the Joint Chiefs throughout the nuclear era to the present day have deliberately omitted entirely from their estimates of the destructive effects of U.S. or Russian nuclear attacks the effects of fire. They have done so on the questionable grounds that these effects are harder to predict than the effects of blast or fallout, on which their estimates of fatalities are exclusively based, even though, as Eden found, experts including Hal Brody have disputed such conclusions for decades. A better hypothesis for the tenacious lack of interest is that accounting for fire would reduce the number of USAF warheads and vehicles required to achieve the designated damage levels, which were themselves set high enough to preclude coverage by available Navy submarine-launched missiles. Yet even in the 60s, the firestorms caused by thermonuclear weapons were known to be predictably the largest producers of fatalities in nuclear war. Given that for almost all strategic nuclear weapons, the damage radius of firestorms would be 2 to 5 times the radius destroyed by the blast, a more realistic estimate of the fatalities caused directly by the planned U.S. attacks on the Sino-Soviet bloc, even in 1961, would surely have been double the summary in the graph I held in my hand, for a total death toll of 1 billion or more, a third of the Earth's population, then 3 billion. Moreover, what no one would recognize for another 22 years were the indirect effects of our planned first strike that gravely threatened the other 2/3 of humanity. These effects arose from another neglected consequence of our attacks on cities, smoke. In effect, in ignoring fire, the chiefs and their planners ignored that where there's fire, there's smoke. But what is dangerous to our survival is not the smoke from ordinary fires, even very large ones. Smoke that remained in the lower atmosphere and would soon be rained out. But smoke propelled into the upper atmosphere from the firestorms that our nuclear weapons were sure to create in the cities we targeted. Ferocious updrafts from these multiple firestorms would loft millions of tons of smoke and soot into the stratosphere, where it would not be rained out and would quickly encircle the globe, forming a blanket blocking most sunlight around the Earth for a decade or more. This would reduce sunlight and lower temperatures worldwide to a point that would eliminate all harvests and starve to death, not all, but nearly all, humans and other animals that depend on vegetation for food. The population of the Southern Hemisphere, spared nearly all direct effects from nuclear explosions, even from fallout, would be nearly annihilated, as would that of Eurasia, which the Joint Chiefs already foresaw from direct effects, Africa and North America. In a sense, the chiefs can't be blamed for their failure to foresee that the firestorms caused by their planned attacks would actually have led to the death by global famine nearly all of humanity, whether that was 3 billion as in 1960 or the 7 billion that exist today. After all, the phenomenon of nuclear winter wasn't predicted by environmental scientists until decades after the Cuban Missile Crisis. Still, one can ask why they didn't explore more vigorously the possible environmental consequences of this unprecedented ecological experiment, an all-out thermonuclear war, for which they were preparing. Or why, more than 30 years since scientists first posited these dangers, and more than 10 years since scientific uncertainties about their calculations have been put to rest, our plans have continued to include options for detonating hundreds of nuclear explosions near cities, which would loft enough soot and smoke into the upper stratosphere to lead to death by starvation of nearly everyone on Earth, including, after all, ourselves. Yet even if I had known all this in 1961, it would scarcely have affected my reaction to the graph I held in my hand that spring morning. Moreover, that unabashed calculation by the JCS said to me then that any confidence, worse it seemed, any realistic hope, that the alert forces on either side might never be used was ill-founded. Americans had built this machine knowing, it turned out, that it would kill more than 500 million people if it were turned on, and they were unhesitant in reporting this to the president. Humans like that would not fail to pull the switch if ordered by a president, or, as I've discussed earlier, possibly on the order of a superior other than the president. And the presidents themselves? A few months prior, Dwight Eisenhower had secretly endorsed the blueprints of this multi-genocide machine. He had furthermore demanded, largely for budgetary reasons, that there be no other plan for fighting the Russians. He had approved this single strategic operational plan, despite reportedly being, for reasons I now understood, privately appalled by its implications. And when the Joint Chiefs responded so promptly to the new president's question about the human impact of our attacks, they clearly assumed that Kennedy would not, in response, order them to resign or be dishonorably discharged, nor order the machine to be dismantled. In that, it turned out, they were right. Surely neither of these presidents actually desired ever to order the execution of these plans, nor would any likely successor. But they all must have been aware, or should have been, of the dangers of allowing such a system to exist. They should have reflected on, and trembled before, the array of contingencies. Accidents, false alarms, outage of communications, Soviet actions misinterpreted by lower commanders, unauthorized action, foolish Soviet initiatives or failure to comply with U.S. threats, escalation stemming from popular uprisings in East Germany or elsewhere in Eastern Europe that might release these pent-up forces beyond their control, or that in ways they had not foreseen could lead them personally to escalate or to initiate a preemptive attack. Eisenhower had chosen to accept these risks, to impose them on humanity and all other forms of life. Kennedy, and later Johnson and Nixon, to my direct knowledge, did likewise. There is much evidence that such catastrophic, major attack options were among choices offered to Presidents Carter, Reagan, and George H.W. Bush, that is, until the end of the Cold War. There is little known publicly about the range of options since then, although 400 Minuteman missiles remain on high alert, along with a comparable number of Trident sub-launched missiles, each alert force more than enough to cause nuclear winter. Moreover, I felt sure in 1961 that the existent potential for moral and physical catastrophe, our government's readiness to commit multi-genocidal extermination on a hemispheric scale by nuclear blast and fallout was not only a product of aberrant Americans or a peculiarly American phenomenon. I was right. A few years later, after the humiliation of the Cuban Missile Crisis and the ouster of Khrushchev, the Russians set out to imitate our destructive capacity in every detail and surpass it where possible. By the end of the decade, they had succeeded. Ever since then,